forest, the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Welcome to The People Speak. I am Malik Johnson. You know, I literally thought for at least all day yesterday on how to introduce our guest today. And I didn't come up with anything satisfactory. But I'm going to say without any reservation that there are simply no words to adequately describe the magnitude, humanitarian efforts, the outspokenness, the determination, and piercing savvy of our guest today. George Galloway is a Scottish politician, currently the Respect Member of Parliament, a political party that he in part founded after he was expelled from the British Labour Party in October 2003 for opposing the invasion of Iraq. George Galloway, the leader who has demonstrated compassion for those who have been oppressed, he's basically pointed out the flaws in government policies in the world, and he has stood up for those who didn't have a voice. I want to say, Mr. Galloway, and I hope that I can call you Mr. Galloway, it is an absolute and complete honor to be in your presence and to speak with you.
Well, I'm extremely grateful for that generous introduction, but the pleasure is all mine, really. I have many friends in the United States, and many of them listen to your show, so it's an honor for me to be on it.
I have witnessed the spankings, the severe spankings that you have given those who have gotten out of line with you. I want to say on the outset, with the utmost respect, I may call you Mr. Galloway, correct?
Yes, of course.
Thank you very much. You know, one of the issues that are near and dear to me is the issue of Palestine, and I wanted to start with your views on Palestine. I noticed in the media coverage that many listeners, I'm sure, have observed that the media in the United States reports each alleged attack by Palestinians on Israel, but oftentimes the media never reports the reason for such an alleged attack, and oftentimes the media in the United States equally ignores Israel's attacks on Palestinians in Palestine. Why do you believe that there is such a clearly lopsided and myopic reporting in the United States and many other countries when dealing with Israel and Palestine?
Well, I'm glad that you began with this subject, because Palestine is the heart of the matter. And unless we solve the Palestine problem, then we will solve nothing in the Middle East. There will be no peace there. And if there's no peace in the Middle East, there will be no peace in the world. This is the flaw at the heart of Western policy towards the East, of the non-Muslim world's policy towards the Muslim world. And the myopia that you describe, it can only be racist in content. It can only be because the blood of Palestinians is less valuable than the blood of Israelis, who are seen somehow as Western people living in the East, which of course is the origin of Israel as a state. It was a settler state of white European people implanted on Arab soil, precisely for the purpose of keeping the Arab world divided and weak, so that the big powers who set up the settler state in the first place could steal its wealth. And as such, it's been an extraordinarily successful project, because nearly 100 years after Mr. Balfour, here in the British Parliament from where I'm speaking to you, authored The Tragedy of the Palestinian People, when on behalf of one country, ours, he promised to a second people, the Zionist leadership, the land which belonged to a third people, the Palestinians, without consulting any of the three people involved, neither the British nor the Jewish people as a whole, and certainly not the Palestinians. And the tragedy in 1917 was written, and everything else has been, as Mr. Churchill described it, a descent down a bloody staircase to hell. And I'm afraid we're not at the bottom of that staircase yet. I give you this example. When the Palestinian family were blown apart on the beach at Gaza by a shell fired from an Israeli gunboat in the Mediterranean, and it was captured live on television, the little girl, the last survivor of her family, staggering around in grief as the pieces, and I mean pieces, of her parents and her brothers and her sisters lay strewn around the beach. This film did not make it onto a single mainstream television program in either your country or mine. In mine, they showed some glimpses of the girl crying, but they didn't show what she was crying about. If a bomb, God forbid, if a bomb went off in a falafel stall in Tel Aviv this evening, it would lead the news in the United States and in Britain. We'd know the names, addresses, we'd know everything about the victims, and it would be automatically assumed that Israel was justified in killing entirely unrelated Palestinians in retaliation for it. That's the double standard that we have on this question in the West, and in particular in the United States.
You talked about the history momentarily, about the how this all came about. What other facts about the Palestine-Israel conflict do you think listeners, especially in the United States of America, do not know and should know?
Well, you know, the Zionist slogan was, a land without people for a people without a land. This presupposed two things. First of all, that French Jews were not really French and did not have a land. British Jews, American Jews, were neither British nor American and they didn't have a land. Now, this was predicated upon the supposed inherent, intrinsic anti-Semitism in European civilization. Now, there was, of course, anti-Semitism in European civilization for hundreds of years, and periodically Jews were subjected to racist pogrom and attack, as other minorities have been from time to time. But the idea that a French Jew was not really French was itself a surrender to anti-Semitism, was itself a vindication of the anti-Semitic thesis that Jews were disloyal and not a part of the society in which they may have lived for many centuries. The second presupposition, which was equally false, was that Palestine was an empty country, when in fact it was a country populated by people called Palestinians, who had lived there for thousands of years. And if the Jews were to leave Brooklyn, London, Vienna, Moscow, and go to Palestine, they were going to have to take the land which was being lived on by the Palestinians. And this is the original sin. This is the heart of this conflict. European settlers, North American settlers, went to an Arab country and took the people's land and wiped their country off the face of the map. You know, we often hear about the Iranian president threatening to wipe Israel off the map. As a matter of fact, he never said any such thing. But of course, the only country that has been erased from the map is Palestine. Check your atlas if you don't believe me. And the Palestinian people, whose country was wiped off the map, were sent to the four corners of the earth as exiles, as refugees, where they have lived for more than half a century since.
You know, I went to ifamericansknew.org, founded by a journalist, Allison Ware. And I learned that 7 years ago, approximately 7,000 Israelis had been injured and approximately 31,000 Palestinians have been injured since this whole issue. I learned also that Israel had been targeted by at least 65 UN resolutions and the Palestinians have been targeted by none. I also learned that Israeli homes have been demolished by Palestine no time, and that Israel had demolished over 4,000 170 Palestinian homes.
And these figures, my friend, are only since the beginning of the Intifada. If you were to begin to calibrate the ocean of blood shed amongst the Palestinian people, the destruction of villages, whole towns, and the carpeting over of those villages by new Zionist settlements and Zionist cities, if you were to calibrate the 50-year agony of refugee status, without passport, without status, without nationality, unable to move from one place to another, regularly hunted from pillar to post, witch hunted, attacked, massacred, over 50 years, you come up with a balance sheet which says, if the Jewish people suffered the greatest crime of the 20th century, which they did, the Palestinian people have suffered the second greatest crime of the 20th century, which is stretched now into the 21st. The Palestinians are now the Jews of the Jews. They are being treated with collective punishment, with pass laws, with punitive walls, and all sorts of ways. They are being treated exactly in the way that the Warsaw Ghetto, for example, a ghetto of Jewish people at the mercy of fascism under Hitler, were treated. And this irony of ironies is lost on the vast majority of people in the world.
Mr. Galloway, something listeners may not know, and something that shocked me as another fact, is that the U.S. United States financial and military support for Israel, in fact, one-third of our foreign aid to all countries, one-third of that goes to Israel.
Yes, actually, 5 million people.
Why is the United States, could you tell us from your perspective, why the United States has so greatly supported Israel, in fact, turning many guaranteed loans into just mere grants?
Well, for the same reason that Britain set Israel up as a settler state in the first place, because it's an outpost of United States interest in a region of immense importance to the United States. When Donald Rumsfeld said in terms that it's not our fault that God put America's oil under other people's countries, he really meant it. And he really meant under the countries of the Arabs and the Venezuelans for that matter. He thinks that the United States, just as Britain when it was an empire, thought that Britain has the right to occupy other people's countries and steal their things. And that's the purpose of Israel. That's why it was founded. That's why the United States today pays every cent that Israel relies upon, gives them every bullet that they fire, every helicopter gunship from which they fire it, every F-16 from which they dive bomb the refugee camps in Gaza, killing children. Every bullet in the back of a Palestinian child is paid for by the taxpayer of the United States of America. And then the taxpayers wonder why the Arab people hate them. They wonder why the Arab people and the Muslim people hate the West, because they don't understand that all of this suffering has been created by and is paid for Western countries like mine and yours.
I oftentimes in the media hear about these claims that the Palestinians are strapping bombs on their children and sending their children into Israel to blow Israelis up. I found no evidence for that proposition, but I did read the Haaretz newspaper that in August 2001, the Haaretz newspaper was talking about that an IDF soldier had shot a child, a Palestinian child, in her heart because the child threw a rock at an IDF tank.
Well, the number of Palestinian children who have been murdered in this way is almost uncountable. And since the Intifada began in 1987, the number of Palestinian children killed runs into thousands. And those maimed and disabled for life runs into many thousands more. And the idea that Arab mothers don't weep for their children like other mothers do is, of course, a racist fantasy. It is the same kind of fantasy that black people in the United States once had to endure. That life was cheap for blacks. Life was cheap for Arabs and Muslims. Well, insofar as that was ever true, it's true to this extent only, that life of blacks, life of Muslims and Arabs is cheap for us, the Western people. They regard. Let me give you an example. Everybody is still mourning, as they should, as they should, the less than 3,000 American citizens and others who were murdered in that atrocity on 9/11 in New York in the Twin Towers. But Iraq is losing 3,000 people every month, and nobody's mourning them. Nobody's counting them even. Nobody's holding memorial services for them. Nobody's building a monument to them. No one's recording their name anywhere, because they're only Arabs. They're only Iraqis. They're only Muslims. That's the truth. You know, when Mrs. Bush said to Mrs. Blair, and it was broadcast on radio, that we must never forget those heartbreaking messages left by those American women on board those aeroplanes on 9/11. She was right, of course. But just because Afghan women don't have mobile telephones and don't have answering machines to leave messages to their loved ones, it doesn't make their deaths any less obscene, delivered from the sky, any less obscene than the deaths of those American women. This, to you and me, is a truth self-evident. But to the powerful people who rule our countries, it's not self-evident at all. The blood of Afghans, the blood of Iraqis, is much less valuable than the blood of white Americans or British people or European and North American settlers in Israel.
Given the current situation in Palestine, how do you think we could help the American people, the listeners? What do you think we should do to try to resolve the situation with the Israel-Palestine conflict?
Well, I should say in advance that I have no expectation whatsoever that the United States is going to change its policy towards the Palestinian people, neither under Bush nor under the next presidency, because so utterly wedded to this policy is virtually the entire American political class that someone like me, who sat for 20 years in the British Parliament, could never be elected in your country. And if they were elected and then they spoke like me, they'd be de-elected at the next election. So nobody has the courage in the American political class to tell the truth, even though many know it. Nobody has the courage to do it. Let me give you one example. A man I admire very much, and I pray to God that he survives and he becomes the President of the United States, Barack Obama. I'd love to see him as the President of the United States. And I tell people that on my radio show and on my television show. And then they send me the words he's spoken in front of Zionist organizations in the United States, which make my blood run cold. And he's the best American politician. He's the only progressive person with a chance of becoming the President of the United States. And even he, never mind Hillary Clinton, don't even get me started on Hillary Clinton, is utterly, unremittingly wedded to the current policy of the United States, which is to arm and finance the settler state of Israel to the suffering and disadvantage of the Palestinian people who have been disinherited. What you have to do, my dear, is the opposite of what you're doing. You have to stop treating the criminal as if they were the victim, and stop treating the victim as if they were the criminal. It's really as simple as that. The Palestinian people are like a man who's been knocked down in the street and everything stolen from him. And when he staggers to his feet bleeding and tries to pursue the person who robbed him, he's accused of being the criminal rather than the criminal who knocked him down and robbed him in the first place.
You know, some have claimed that the conflict between Palestine and Israel is an Israeli Holocaust against Palestine and Palestinians. You know, speaking of the Holocaust, you mentioned the issue of anti-Semitic and Semites. And I had done some research and discovered that many claim that you're anti-Semitic. And I looked at the etymology of Semite and learned that it was a religious connotation, and it refers to Semitic languages, Afro-Asiatic languages, in which Arabic is the largest Afro-Asiatic Semitic language. How can your critics claim that you are anti-Semitic when you clearly do not have animosity toward Semites and particularly Arab people?
Well, they do so for the base reason that they really don't have much else left to throw. Because the argument that I'm making here is simply unanswerable. And if one is to imagine that we're going to get stability and peace in the Middle East, one knows that some solution for the Palestinian people is going to have to be produced. I am a man of the left and have been since I was 13 years old when I joined the Labour Party. I hate racism with every fiber of my being. Anti-Semitism is a form of racism, exactly like a hatred of black people or a hatred of any other ethnic group. Now, the idea that someone like me, as a leading leftist figure for more than 30 years in British politics, is a racist, is of course completely fantastical, completely and utterly ridiculous. But they have to use this stick because it's their last weapon, the last refuge of the scoundrel who wants to defend Israel. What I'm talking about now has nothing to do with Jews or Judaism. You don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist. George Bush is not a Jew. I doubt if they even allow Jews in his golf club. But he's a Zionist. Noam Chomsky is a Jew, but he's not a Zionist. So the idea that this has anything to do with Judaism or Jews as a religion or Jews as a people is ridiculous. I'm opposing Israel. I'm opposing Zionism. These are political concepts, nothing to do with race. Nothing. Listen, there are Jewish people in Israel living on Palestinian land who are black people from Ethiopia, who are falashas, who say that they're Jewish, are acceptable as Jewish, and they can come from Ethiopia and take the land and the house of a Palestinian who's lived there, their family has lived there for thousands of years. Well, the Ethiopian has never been there, ever in history. There are Chinese Jews who have the right to go to Palestine and take land and homes belonging to Palestinians who've lived there for thousands of years. And the Chinese man has never been in Palestine. This is a racist ideology. This is an apartheid state of Israel.
You were talking about the black Jews, the Beta Israelis, the Falashans, being accepted. I don't know about that, Mr. Galloway. Now, see, I've read stories just the opposite of how many people.
Well, that's right. They're third class. They're third class.
Right.
Israel, this is how Israel is stratified.
Right.
First is the European Jews.
Right.
Second is the Oriental Jews.
Right.
Third is the black Falasha Jews.
Right.
Fourth is the Palestinians who live inside Israel 1948.
Right.
And fifth is the Palestinians who live under the occupation of 67.
Absolutely.
Five classes of apartheid.
And you were talking about the only last thing that they have is the anti-Semitic claim, and most Semites are actually Arabs. One of the other interesting things is kind of like when people throw out the term Holocaust denier. You know, as of late, many have claimed that a person is a Holocaust denier when you question the actual numbers of those who unfortunately died during the Holocaust. You know, for those who make such a claim, I oftentimes wonder if is such a claim not tantamount to calling individuals transatlantic slave deniers because the individuals question the actual numbers of those who unfortunately died during the transatlantic slave trade. Are the Native American genocide deniers because an individual questions the actual number of those who unfortunately died during such a genocide? I often find that term, you know, closely related to when they shoot out the anti-Semitic, and then after that they say called a Holocaust denier or that you're anti-Jewish and all these other things. I have to oftentimes remind people that being a Jew has nothing to do with race at all, and I thank you for pointing that out. I do want to ask you this. Because you were talking about Lebanon, and I remember this. You were Anna, and I'm flipping to another subject. In July 2006, during the Lebanon, well, actually Israel's invasion of Lebanon, And a lot of people thought that at that time that whole issue began with the two IDF soldiers, and it certainly did not begin with the two IDF soldiers. And I remember Anna from Sky News, and she was talking about, and she asked you on August 8, 2006, were you, do you believe that Hezbollah had a setback as a result of this particular conflict? And you stated to Anna, you said, what a silly question. You said, what a silly person you are.
Yes. How did Anna interview that one?
How did Anna come to even think or imply that Israel was winning? That when Israel couldn't possibly destroy Hezbollah, in fact, Hezbollah is stronger now than Hezbollah was before.
Yes, and the Israeli government is weaker than it's ever been before. The current prime minister currently has an opinion poll standing of 5%, the lowest in Israeli political history. So, of course, they lost the war in Lebanon, as they entirely accept. If you read the Israeli press, you listen to the chatter in their army chat rooms and so on, you know that they accept that they lost the war in Lebanon. That doesn't mean they're not going to try again. And indeed, last Sunday's Israeli press was full of talk of another war next month in July in the Lebanon. And maybe also an Israeli attack on Iran, maybe an Israeli attack on Gaza to try and crush the Hamas movement there. Israel is constantly on a war footing. The United States constantly weaponizes it for such a war footing. And that's the fundamental problem, I'm afraid.
Amazing. I also want to mention, because people are in the audience and they want to speak to you as well. They like to question, call in and question, offer you some questions to you. But on May 17th, and this is another issue, 2005, you were before the United States senators, in which some had accused you of profiting from Iraq oil dealings as a British MP. You responded to the senators' claims that was a mother of all, that they were the mother of all smoke screens. In fact, during the hearing, Senator Levin was discussing illegalities, and you interjected. You said, please, Senator, you supported the illegal attack on Iraq. Don't talk to me about illegality.
Yes.
And
that
Senator Levin, by the grace of God,
I found my wings that day. And when I came out of the Senate building, a black janitor said to me, way to go, man, you sent George Bush back to his ranch. And then I knew I had a triumph on my hands.
I swear, when you were during that hearing, I could hear people on the left, minorities throughout the United States, myself, we just jumped up. You know, it really even hit home when you said, Senator Levin wanted to return a question to you, and you said, because he wanted to talk about illegality, and you asked him, do you want to talk about illegality? And Senator Levin said, no. And I was thinking to myself, this is the end of this. But you kept on. You said, you know, you launched an illegal war, which you're absolutely correct, which has killed over 100,000 people, which is more today. And you told him, you want me to be troubled? I said, this is a TKO. I knew that you had boxing. I said, I could tell you were trained in boxing.
It's funny, brother, that you should say that, because I was a boxer, and I know from experience, when you're in a boxing ring, there comes a moment when you can tell from the eyes of your opponent that he has lost the will to fight, that he wishes he was not there, that he wishes the bell would ring. And I saw that look in the eyes of Levin and Coleman. Coleman started that day as a presidential hopeful, but he didn't end the day as a presidential hopeful. And by the way, when he's up for election in Minnesota next, I'm coming there. I'm going to hunt him like Muhammad Ali hunted Sonny Liston for the fight. I'm going to go around with a net to try and catch him. I'm going to spank him.
You know, I had never seen or witnessed an international figure coming to our house, so calm and collected as you please. You spanked our representative, and you left our house as calm as and collected as you came in. I said, my goodness. And, you know, that's one time I think everybody had to take notice to who you were and who they were dealing with. They were really not, they simply could not match you.
As George Bush would say, they misunderestimated me.
Out of curiosity. Oh, I have to get to the callers because everybody wants to ask you a question. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and start the calling if you don't mind, Mr. Galloway.
No, go ahead.
There is a Cindy from England. She has a question for you, Mr. Galloway. Cindy, come and please ask your question to Mr. Galloway.
Hello?
Oh, hello, George.
Hi, Cindy.
George, is what you think about Tony Blair getting the new peace envoy job. Cheers.
Well, it's a bit like putting Count Dracula in charge of the blood transfusion system. It's asking for trouble. This man has created more death and destruction in the Middle East from the Levant in Lebanon all the way to the Arabian Gulf. He's been responsible for more death and destruction than practically anyone in history. And the idea that he's going to go now and be a peace envoy in Palestine when he's already declared that he's Israel's best friend in the world is simply absurd.
What do you think of James Gordon Brown, who's the new Prime Minister of the United Kingdom?
Well, he's a better chap than Mr. Blair in the sense that he's a more honest and decent person. He's not a liar. And he hasn't yet been directly responsible for war crimes like Mr. Blair. But I'm afraid that it's a bit like, as I put it, two cheeks of the same backside. Two cheeks of the same ass. I don't think there'll be much difference.
Mr. Galloway, in very raw, very piercing terms, what do you think of George Bush?
Well, I feel sorry for the people of the United States that such a man should be their leader. Your country is the greatest country in the world, the mightiest, the richest, the most successful country in the world. Can you really not find somebody better than him to be the leader of your country? This man is inches from imbecility. This man is inches from being a certifiable idiot.
Oh, man. I love this guy. I love you, man. We got another caller. David from Canada. David, please come up here and ask your question of Mr. Galloway.
Thank you very much.
David.
It's a privilege and pleasure. Mr. Galloway, there's about a handful of males on this planet that I can publicly say I'm in love with, and you're certainly one of them.
Thank you, David.
Do you think will happen with the situation in Iran within the near future? I know there's a lot of propaganda attacking Iran. What do you think is going to happen within the near future, and what's your opinion on the situation? Go ahead, sir.
Well, David, thanks for that. The situation is very dangerous now. The war propaganda, which led to the attack on Iraq, has been repeated and reprised in all the usual places. Israel is ready to do the job for the United States. But I'm bound to tell you, attacking Iraq was just about as big a mistake as it's possible to imagine. But if anything, attacking Iran will be an even bigger mistake. Iran is not a broken-backed country, almost destroyed by more than a decade of war and sanctions. Iran is a powerful country, a rich country, with a huge Islamic weight, a huge historical weight. It has a huge population. It has a big country, and it has friends all over the world. And any attack by Israel will be treated as an attack by the United States. And Iran will answer. She will answer, first of all, in Iraq, where Bush and Blair, the idiots, have made Iran top dog. And Iran is in a position in Iraq to set the ground on fire underneath the British and American armed forces there. She will answer in the Gulf, in the satrapies, in the corrupt kingdoms of the Arabian Gulf. She'll set them on fire. And you won't be worrying about oil at $60 or $70 a barrel. You will not be able to buy oil at $500 a barrel because the oil fields will be on fire. She will answer in Lebanon with her friends there. She will answer in Palestine with her friends there, and she will answer in our own countries. Let's be clear about this. If Iran is attacked by Israel and or the United States, which, as I say, is the same thing, Iran will answer. The days when you could go out and attack people and they didn't hit you back are gone now. So, even at this 11th hour, if the Democratic Party in the United States can find some courage, for God's sake, to stand up and stop this inexorable drift towards yet another war, then we can still stop it. But short of that, it may be that we're sleepwalking into yet another disaster. Now, for those who say the United States will never enter another war when it's already bogged down in one, well, they don't know the lesson of Cambodia and Vietnam. When the United States was sinking in the mire in Vietnam, Nixon and Kissinger spread the war to Cambodia, and more than 2 million people died as a result.
Thank you very much. Mr. Galloway, could you mention, you mentioned the issue about Ahmadinejad not saying wipe Israel off the map. And I know exactly what he did say in Farsi, I believe. I was wondering if you could share exactly what Ahmadinejad did in fact say as far as that phrase is concerned.
Yes, it's very important. And now this is agreed by every Farsi authority in the world. But the Zionist lie machine continues to pump out the lie that Ahmadinejad, whom I don't support, by the way, said that he wanted to wipe Israel off the map. He said, and he was quoting Ayatollah Khomeini, that just as Nazism and communism was wiped from history, so Zionism would one day be similarly wiped. He wasn't talking about the Jews driving them into the sea. He wasn't talking about the Israelis who were born there and now have national rights there. He was talking about the ideology of Zionism, the racist, apartheid ideology of Zionism. He said it would die like communism died, like fascism died. Well, what's wrong with that? That's a legitimate political aspiration. One, by the way, which is shared very widely.
Yeah, there really is no idiom in Farsi. In fact, he has stated that just as the Soviet Union was wiped out, the Reuters had said just as the Soviet Union was wiped out and today does not exist, so will the Zionist regime soon be wiped out. But they totally missed in December 13, 2006. Reuters totally screwed that up. He had not said that at all. He was talking about the regime.
A lie is halfway around the world before the truth has even got its boots on. And when you have people whose job it is to propel that lie around the world, then you see how difficult it is to catch up with it.
We have another speaker, another caller, actually. Caller, Mohammed Hosni from Cairo. Mohammed, please come to them. Mike, and ask your question to Mr. Galloway.
Hello, Mr. Galloway. What I'd like to know, please, is don't you think when the U.S. and the British government talk about eliminating terrorism, they're actually spreading it by saying we target Islamists and that we're in an ideological crusade and that we should kill extremists, meaning Muslim people? Don't you think by this and by Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, they're actually spreading it like a domino rather than containing it?
Yes, I of course accept that, absolutely. I said in Parliament here just 4 days after 9/11, I said if we handle this the wrong way, we will create 10,000 new bin Ladens. And in fact, that was a serious underestimation. We have created hundreds of thousands of new bin Ladens. Bin Laden, by the way, who was once an American agent, who was given weapons and money and moved around the world serving American interests on the immoral principle that my enemy's enemy is my friend. But actually, your enemy's enemy isn't always your friend. Sometimes your enemy's enemy is worse than your friend.
Well, yeah, there was a question someone had posed to me earlier today. Steve from New York asked a question about Tony Blair's accomplishment in Sierra Leone. What do you think of that? What did he accomplish in Sierra Leone?
This is just imperialist propaganda with Africa as the white man's burden. Tony Blair supported one group of diamond thieves against another group of diamond thieves. That's all.
Just as
in Afghanistan, he supported one gang of warlords against another gang of warlords. The only difference being, the gang of warlords he supported have multiplied heroin production in Afghanistan by 900% since we put them in power. The Taliban were a group of brigands and warlords, yes, but at least they were actually destroying the heroin. Our brigands and warlords are vastly increasing the supply of it. And the result is to be found on the dark stairwells of the Bronx and of Glasgow and of London.
Absolutely. I agree. Jansen, there's another caller, Jansen from South London. Please ask your question of Mr. Galloway.
Greetings, gentlemen. Hello, Big Lad.
Hi there.
This is quite a simple one. As respects to Brown being our new Prime Minister, where do you see our relationships with the US, with South America, with the East going? And is Brown old boy network? Thank you, George.
Well, as I say, they're two cheeks of the same ass. They are responsible for all of this, and they are co-conspirators in all of this. The only point I'm making is that Brown is at least on a moral level of a different order to Mr. Blair. And whilst we had no chance of a change of policy under Mr. Blair, at least now that we have a new Prime Minister and a new Foreign Minister, there is an opening, there is a possibility of a change. And that's what we're fighting for.
Thank you, Jensen, from South London. Here, and there's another caller, Jalal. Jalal from Australia. Please ask your question to Mr. Galloway.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Galloway. It was a real pleasure listening to you, as always. My question is regarding the conflict in the Lebanese Palestinian refugee camps, and what is your perspective on the Zionist Israeli and American involvement in that region? And is it justifiable to say that that Syria is involved in any way in these conflicts? Thank you.
I don't believe so. I believe that Lebanon is being used as a knife to stab Syria in the back. And the confessional divisions that exist in Lebanon and always have existed in Lebanon are being played by the big powers and by Israel. I think that the reason they're targeting Syria is not because of any bad things that Syria has done, and she has done bad things, but because of the bad things she refuses to do, like surrender peace with Israel, like giving up her land in the Golan, like expelling, she refuses to expel the Hamas leadership from Damascus. She refuses to allow her country to be used as an armed camp to attack Iraq. This is the reason they're targeting Syria, and they're using the confessional divisions inside Lebanon to fashion Lebanon into a knife to stab Syria in the back. And this is the time for all people from what we know as Bilad al-Sham, the land of Sham, the Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, not to be divided anymore. The Arabs are divided enough without allowing themselves to be divided between Sunni and Shia, Druze, people from the north, people from the south. Really, Sykes-Picot divided the Arabs enough. Let's not fall for it all over again.
Thank you, Jalal from Australia. We have another caller, Carola, I believe, from Sweden. Please come up and ask your question, Mr. Galloway.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Galloway, here's another one, absolutely in love with you. A little wrestler from Sweden, by the way. We might have fun someday. What I'd like to ask you is, a man of your capacity, since it seems to me that we have a self-appointed world-selected leader on the planet that only Americans got to vote for, would you consider profiling yourself globally and organize and unite us, all the people of the world, since I'm absolutely convinced that a majority of the people fully do agree with you, and a voice with words of truth is what is really needed here. We need somebody to unite people.
Well, I'm grateful for that confidence that you've shown me. People can contact me through my website at georgegalloway.com, and you can listen to the radio shows that I do every Friday and Saturday night between 10 p.m. London time and 1 a.m. London time on a radio station called Talk Sport. Don't be put off by the sport bit, it's just the talk I do. And you can get that on the internet at www.talksport.net. And I've got people listening to these shows, 3 hours Friday, 3 hours Saturday, all over the world. I also do a television show, which you can see at sumo.tv, that's sumo.tv, / George Galloway. One word, George Galloway. I'm trying to do my best within the limitations of the breath that's left in me, and I'm trying to unite people around the world on this basis. All those, whether they're Islamic or whether they're socialist or whether they're secular or whether they're religious people, we all have the same enemy, the enemy of untrammeled, savage, globalized capitalism and imperialism and war. And we may have differences on gay rights or attitude to this or that aspect of culture. We may have differences about whether we believe there's a God or not. But on these giant issues, we are one. And we should be one. Our enemy is one. And we should be as one also.
Very well stated. I agree. Thank you, Carola. From Sweden, I certainly appreciate that question. We have another caller, Matthew. Matthew from Texas. Please ask your question, Mr. Galloway.
Mr. Galloway, I was wondering, what do you think about free speech throughout Europe with Mr. David Irving getting jailed for pretty much speaking his own mind? I was just wanting to know what you think about that in particular issue when it comes to free speech. Do you think it should
no,
be
curbed? No, I don't. I'm going to lose at least one friend here. I don't agree that there's an absolute right to free speech. I don't have the absolute right, for example, to shout fire in a cinema, because the impact of shouting fire in a cinema will be to damage other people. And I don't believe, for example, that the United States Nazi Party has the right to jackboot through Jewish areas or black areas in the United States. I don't believe the Ku Klux Klan has a free speech right to preach that black people are monkeys or apes. So I don't accept that there's an unlimited right of free speech. And I believe that David Irving is a Holocaust denier. He is secretly in love with Hitler. And he wishes, if there wasn't 6 million, that there had been 6 million. He wishes there were no Jews left in the world. He's a racist. And I think that it's important for people on the left not to be drawn into this Holocaust denial area. Let's accept that there was a Holocaust, with a capital H, where a fascist ideology sought to systematically annihilate an entire group of people, not for anything they'd done, but for who they were. That's the same kind of mentality as the KKK. It's the same kind of mentality as David Irving, and it should be opposed by all progressive people.
Thank you, Matthew from Texas. We have a Bobby caller, Bobby from California. Please come and ask your question of Mr. Galloway.
Well, thank you, Mr. Galloway. I'm a Palestinian advocate. I've advocated Palestine for all my life, and when I'm in the presence of you and Mr. Johnson, Malik Johnson, I don't feel compelled to talk on the issue. You talk plenty on it, and you do very well. I want to talk to you about the country of Zimbabwe. The country of Zimbabwe, the people of Zimbabwe have fought hard and long to regain their country and to reestablish their freedom and liberty. When they got their country, they got nothing but shanty towns, and they were, the world forgot all about these people that fought for their freedom. And now they are being punished. The whole population, the whole country is being suffocated, starved, and made hungry because of the sanctions. What can be done internationally to alleviate this situation and end the British Commonwealth embargo on the people of Zimbabwe? Your mic.
Well, Brother Johnson, this will have to be the last one, I'm afraid, because I have to go now. It's 1 hour scheduled, and I can only do 1 hour because I have someone now to drive to the other side of London. Zimbabwe is an interesting subject to end upon. I agree with you up to a point. I agree with you that the African people of Zimbabwe were forced by white racism and colonialism to overthrow the rulers of their settler state. And they had to wade through the blood of their people in order to free their country. And Robert Mugabe was a great liberation movement leader. But I think he's been a bloody awful prime minister. Of course, he was handicapped from the beginning by the Lancaster House Agreement, by which he agreed that for 20 years, the land would not be redistributed to the black people in Zimbabwe. And that after 20 years, the British government would help finance a stable transfer of land from the white settlers to the majority population. And of course, the sanctions have been extremely damaging to Zimbabwe. But Mugabe is a bad leader. It would have been better for him and better for his reputation and better for the people of Zimbabwe if he passed away 10 or 15 years ago. Instead, he has led the country in a way which has made it an absolute basket case, way beyond what the international impact of sanctions would have been if he'd been a good leader. I'm sorry to say that. I supported the liberation struggle in Zimbabwe. I support it still. I honor the contribution made by Mugabe and ZANU-PF in the liberation of their country. But we have an obligation to be clear and frank. The way in which the dictatorship now has developed in Zimbabwe has been grossly detrimental to the people of Zimbabwe, has helped to destabilize to some extent its relations with South Africa just across the border. And the best thing to do would be for ZANU-PF to find a new leader. Robert Mugabe is more than 80 years old, for God's sake. He's been in power for long enough. It's time for him to go.
Thank you, Mr. Galloway. Please come back to The People Speak. We love listening to you. We absolutely...
I'll come back any time we can arrange it, brother.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Galloway.
It's been an honor talking to you.
And you take care.
Thank you, brother. Bye now. Bye.
Bye-bye. You all heard it. George Galloway, the great. I absolutely love George Galloway. And I thought it was a very solid interview as well. And everyone got to participate in this, and I didn't hog the mic. I thought this was really, really informative, and it was indeed a treat. I am Malik Johnson. I'm going to sign off, but before I do, I want to say this. The next guest we have is Greg Guma, the National Executive Director of Pacifica Radio. And we are also asking for donations, The People Speak. If you can make donations, we would certainly appreciate that so we can continue to bring you good, good shows. Thanks a lot. I'm Malik Johnson. I'm signing off. Thank you for joining us.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the table by the relief office I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.
That was a great interview, Vu. Thank you very much. And thank you, Peace Lover, for making it all happen. And, of course, thank you, audience, for coming. It was a great show, and I hope you all enjoyed it. So, bye.